Joining me in the studio is Latino USA producer Antonia Cerejido.
Hi, Maria.
So, Antonia, we've been talking about one person for a while now. His name is Juan Sanchez.
Yes, and I remember the day that you and I both heard about him. It was that day that Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon flew to Texas to see what was happening at a shelter on the border where he heard that children who had been separated in the zero tolerance policy were being held.
Senator Jeff Merkley is a Democrat from Oregon, but he spent his Sunday in Texas. While he was there, he spent some of that time getting written up by police in the parking lot of what used to be a Walmart supercenter.
The Walmart supercenter had been converted into a migrant shelter.
Right, and there are cameras that showed up. It became a big scene. And then the police were called on the senator.
What was your name again? I'm sorry, Senator?
Senator Jeff Merkley. Jeff, U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley.
Yeah, and then the senator was turned away from the shelter. And that moment, it became sort of like emblematic.
It was emblematic of this feeling like, wait, what is going on? What's happening? There are secrets being kept, places we can't get into. It was all very kind of murky.
So in that footage, Senator Merkley asks a staff member at the shelter for the name of her supervisor.
Yes, what is his name?
His name is Juan Sanchez.
Juan Sanchez?
And that's how we first hear of Juan Sanchez. As it turns out, Juan Sanchez is not just this woman's supervisor. He's the CEO of Southwest Key Programs, which is a nonprofit organization that reportedly holds the largest contract with the government to house these migrant kids.
Southwest Key runs Casa Padre, the shelter Senator Merkley was denied access to, along with 26 other shelters for migrant children spread across Texas, Arizona, and California.
After the Merkley incident, Southwest Key immediately came under fire. One headline read, "Meet the couple who facilitated Trump's order to snatch kids from parents," in reference to Juan and his wife, who also works at Southwest Key. Another headline said, "A Latino nonprofit is holding separated kids. Is that care or complicity or both?" Most recently, Southwest Key has been under fire for allegations of abuse in its shelters, which we'll get to later.
Yet, if you look on Southwest Key's website, you're going to find a different narrative. There, it says that Juan has served on the board of several important organizations, including the National Council of La Raza, which is now known as Unidos U.S. It's one of the most prominent Latino advocacy groups in the country. Juan Sanchez has also won multiple social justice awards, including awards specifically for his work on behalf of immigrant children.
When you and I first read this bio several months back in June, it felt jarring. The description seemed the opposite of what was being said about Sanchez in the press. He was being portrayed as this, like, evil guy who was holding children who were forced from the arms of their parents in child detention. But his official bio portrayed him as this Latino social justice champion.
Right. So which one is it? I mean, it's confusing, right? And we were immediately intrigued.
Yeah. So I reached out to Southwest Key Programs to see if Juan would sit down for an interview with you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with me on Latino USA. We appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Maria.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, the moral dilemma of Juan Sanchez. We ended up doing multiple interviews with Juan Sanchez. The first one was back in June, back when everywhere you looked, family separation and the zero tolerance policy was in the headlines. Juan went to a local station in Austin, and I spoke to him from our studios in Harlem.
We get requests for a lot of interviews, and I've really just not done very many because you understand. But there's a few that I select to do, and this is one of them. So thank you for inviting me.
Why did you say yes to our interview?
Because you're Latina. And because it's Latino USA, and that means a lot to me.
And why does it mean a lot to you?
Because I'm a Latino, and we have been, fighting for Latino causes all my life.
Juan grew up in Brownsville, Texas, right on the border with Mexico.
There were nothing but Latinos for blocks and blocks and blocks, so you never even knew that other people outside of Latinos existed.
Juan says his father was a custodian for a rail line, and his mother was a stay-at-home mom that raised him and his six siblings. He has memories of walking to school with his siblings and neighbors.
And everybody had dreams about what they wanted to be when they grew up. Eventually, when we became teenagers, some of my friends began to get arrested. What I noticed when they came back home is that brightness in their eyes and that spirit of my dreams and what I want to be when I grow up, there was no longer there. So I said to myself, when I grow up, I want to do something to help my friends.
When he was a teenager, Juan says that he actually wanted to become a probation officer. He says those were some of the only people that he saw trying to help his friends stay on track in life. He eventually grew out of that idea when he went to college and went to Harvard for his doctoral degree in education. What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation was on Chicano alternative schools in the Southwest.
Juan was interested in juvenile justice work. He founded Southwest Key with the idea of creating alternatives to incarceration and detention for young people. As part of the program, he created a group home in Texas for at-risk youth.
Later on, though, Juan got a contract to start working with unaccompanied minors. Those are teens and children who arrive at the border by themselves. That part of your program, when did that develop?
About 20 years ago.
Does somebody pick up the phone? You get a phone call?
No.
What was going on?
It's interesting that, you know, there was a revolution going on in El Salvador. And so there were thousands of people coming into Brownsville. And of course, Brownsville is my area, and we were doing work down there with juvenile justice.
That's when Juan opened his first shelter for migrant youth. And since then, Southwest Key's shelter operations have expanded a lot. They now have 27 shelters and over 7,000 workers. At this point, I had a lot of other questions, but I decided to ask them in person since Juan had told me that there was a possibility of touring one of his shelters. I'd love to know if, one, I can meet you in person, and two, if you would actually, if you would be my escort into one of your facilities.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. Wherever you want to go, Maria, we'll make accommodations for you. The only thing we have to do is, of course, you know, we have to get permission from the Office of Refugee Resettlement to make sure that you're allowed to go in. But we're always making requests. Some people they say yes to, and some people they say no to. So I don't know. It depends on your popularity. They might tell you no.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
Juan made it sound like it was going to be easy to visit the shelters he runs, but that did not end up being the case.
ORR is the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and it's the government department that oversees unaccompanied minors. And Antonia, you immediately submitted a request to ORR for us to visit a shelter.
Yeah, so 3 days later, I got an email back saying that no media tours of any Southwest Key locations were available. I wrote back to them again, no response. I followed up multiple times with ORR and Southwest Key staffers to see if we could get access. Nothing. It became clear we were not going to be given access to one of these shelters. But we still had questions for Juan, so we asked if we could visit him in Austin, and he said yes.
But before we get into what happened when we went down to Austin and visited Juan Sanchez and the Southwest Key headquarters in Austin, it's important to understand some of the context and how the sheltering of migrant children works in general. So here we go.
When a minor arrives at the U.S.-Mexico border, first, a Customs and Border Patrol agent takes them to a processing center. That's where the viral images of children in cages, of children in those space blankets that look like aluminum foil, were taken. It's also where that really disturbing audio of a Border Patrol officer teasing children as they cry after they were separated from their parents was recorded.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
All of those were taken at a processing center run by Border Patrol.
By law, minors should stay there for a maximum of 72 hours. They're then taken from the processing center to a shelter overseen by ORR, which is the kind of facility that Juan operates. Minors stay at these shelters for an average of around 60 days until they can be reunited with a sponsor who's typically a parent, a family member, or a family friend. And then the child stays with that sponsor while they go through the process of seeking a legal pathway to stay in the United States.
Prior to 2012, the number of unaccompanied minors usually hovered around 6,000 to 8,000 a year. But then the number started to grow until 2014 when it skyrocketed. That year, about 50,000 minors were referred to ORR. President Obama called it, quote, an urgent humanitarian situation. Southwest Key's budget increased rapidly as the organization expanded to meet the need of housing many of these children. Then the number of minors coming dipped in 2015, leading Southwest Key to lay off many of its workers.
Southwest Key's employees were given the pink slip throughout the state. While some expected the layoff offer, others were caught off guard.
But CBS then the numbers of unaccompanied minors started to go up again. And in 2017, after the Trump administration took office, ORR contracted with Southwest Key to build what would become the largest shelter in the country for immigrants who were minors. That's Casa Padre, the converted Walmart in Brownsville.
But starting this year, it wasn't just children coming on their own. There were also kids that had been taken from their parents at the border because of the zero tolerance policy.
And many of those kids, the ones separated from their parents at the border, ended up at one of Juan Sanchez's facilities. And so all of a sudden, all of the scrutiny comes onto Juan Sanchez and Southwest Key, especially after it became known that ORR had contracted Southwest Key for so much money. Southwest Key Programs has won around $1 billion in federal contracts since 2015. In 2016, Juan himself made over $1.5 million.
So we went to Austin to ask which narrative about Juan Sanchez is the right one. Is he a Chicano social justice leader? Or is he a man who's profiting off of immigrant children? Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Babbel, a language program that quickly teaches real-life conversations in a new language. Choose from Spanish, French, Italian, German, and more. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons use interactive dialogues and speech recognition technology to get you speaking your new language correctly and confidently. Try Babbel for free by downloading the app or going to Babbel, Babbel.com.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're kicking off a new season with legendary singer-songwriter Erykah Badu.
That's why they call me Fat Belly Bella, because they never know when I'm going to be impregnated.
Subscribe now.
Hey, we're back. And when we left off, Antonia Cerejido and I were on our way down to Austin, Texas, to meet Juan Sanchez and speak to him directly.
Hi, good morning.
Do you like dogs?
No.
Okay. It was late July, and we were met at the door by Juan's very energetic dog.
And we were asked not to give any information about their home or their location. And that's because this family has been the subject of a lot of protests and even death threats.
Juan is 70 years old, and he lives with his wife, Jennifer, and their three young children.
So your name is?
Cesar.
And your name is?
Tenok.
Tenok. Can you tell me about your name?
It's the first Aztec king.
Antonia?
Yeah.
Those are some pretty radical Chicano names.
Yeah. Cesar after Cesar Chavez and Tenoch after an Aztec king.
And their third son is named after Juan. And I asked little Juan what he wanted to do when he grew up.
I don't know. I just want to be known, kind
of. Ooh. Known for what?
Anything, really. Just something good, not something bad.
And good for you, like when you say I want to do something good, like what is that?
Like good for my community or just as long as I'm not hurting anyone to do it. Like my dad having a job that helps other people, anything like that.
So we're hanging out at the house, making small talk, and Juan, kind of out of nowhere, starts to tell us this story of a recent family vacation to California, where he and his kids visited the Museum of Tolerance. He said that the museum impacted him a lot.
Interesting walking through there and listening to how Hitler came to power. And the way they t- took the Jewish people and made them the scapegoat for every problem that they had. And it reminded me of Latinos in the U.S. right now. When you listen to Trump talk about Latinos, it's like, they're like the cause of every murder, every rape, every robbery is because of these Latinos. And you kind of go like, wow, they just put those people in a place that where they're not even human beings anymore. They're not looked upon as human beings and people who need to be destroyed. And I was looking at this and I was saying, wow, it's some similarities there.
We left Juan's house and we went to his office at the Southwest Key headquarters. In addition to the migrant shelters, Southwest Key continues to do juvenile justice work. They run after-school programs, summer camps, and even a charter school, East Austin College Prep.
Their headquarters, which are in East Austin, looked like a large corporate office building. Really shiny, lots of glass, big, like three or four buildings that are together in a kind of complex. And inside Juan's office, there's a mosaic rendering of Martin Luther King Jr. There's a plaque of his doctoral degree from Harvard. And there's a poster with a quote from the revolutionary Che Guevara.
You know, this is one of my favorite sayings of Che Guevara, who said that at the risk of seeming ridiculous, the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. And I'd like to think that that's who we are and what we try to do.
We sat down for our interview, and that's when Juan told us that several months ago he noticed that something was changing at the shelters that he was running for migrant children.
One of the things I check every single day is the number of kids we have. For the last year, and it varies every year, but for the last year we'd have a number of kids increasing on a regular basis. We're going anywhere from 25 to 50 kids. All of a sudden, you begin to see more, 75 to 100 kids a day coming in.
He said he actually first heard about the zero tolerance policy of separating children and parents on the news.
And so, you know, I talked to our staff and said, are we getting these unaccompanied minor kids that have been separated? And they said, yes, we are. And then the difference, too, was that there were smaller kids, many smaller kids.
Juan says he gathered his senior staff.
And so we had to make a decision. And in the end, we felt somebody's got to take care of these kids. And these, we don't take them, somebody else is going to take them. Could be a private for-profit company that does it.
Juan and his team had to make a choice. Were they going to shelter these kids who were taken from their parents, or were they going to say no, and as a result, risk losing their contract with ORR that happens to make up 85% of their budget?
So we just geared up our staff to begin to serve a lot more younger kids. And I think we did a very good job, but people see you as this evil person for having done that. Very evil person for having taken these kids that have been separated from their families. And I think for some people, they just can't get over that, that that's a decision that we made.
I asked Juan if he grasped the moral dilemma of that decision. The moral dilemma being, if I collaborate with the U.S. government in this policy, then I'm in one way or another implicated in the policy, as opposed to saying, I will have nothing to do with that.
I think that's the problem. And I think that it may be part of what I failed to realize in the beginning, right? But the decision wasn't that easy, right? Because the decision was really all that we've been doing for 20 years was going to end for us. And we're willing to end that.
The way he saw it, he either had to comply with the government or get out of the business of sheltering kids altogether. Despite his role in housing the kids, Juan says that he is not in favor of the zero tolerance policy.
Well, I think everybody in this country has come to understand that this is not a good policy. It's terrible. It's traumatic for kids. It's just a very difficult policy to. It was a very difficult policy to create a lot of problems, and that's why it doesn't exist anymore. And my hope is that that's the way it's going to stay.
After the Trump administration ended the policy of breaking up families at the border, people continued to protest outside of the offices of Southwest Key.
Free the children now! On the deadline day to end family separation, these activists are still aiming anger at Southwest Key over the federal operations.
And we're here to say to the city and the county, end your contracts, every penny of public money.
One of the people who protested outside of Southwest Key is Patty Quincy from the Texas chapter of the American Federation of Teachers.
When we are supporting an organization that benefits from child detention, then we're supporting child detention. And Southwest Key sought out these contracts for the child detention centers, these tender age baby prisons throughout the U.S.
Patty, who is Mexican-American herself, was surprised to learn that Juan was the CEO of Southwest Keys.
As a Latina, it's just incredibly disappointed to see people that look like me cashing in on the kids that look like us.
One of the most common criticisms about Juan is about his compensation. He was paid about $1.5 million in 2016. In a statement, the Southwest Key Board of Directors defended Juan's salary, saying that their, quote, executives are compensated in line with what executives earn across comparable nonprofits.
And the other secret is, it's people of color. That's who's in our cabinet. No, one white person and everybody else is a person of color. And we've been very, very, very successful. And I think that diversity is part of what makes us successful. The fact that we pay people well and take care of them makes us there. But there is this jealousy. People just cannot understand, why do you make so much money? It's incomprehensible to people.
In general, Juan's been confused by what he sees as a turn in public opinion on him. It was just 2 years ago that Republicans were angry that federal funding was going towards the shelters. But today, it's progressives like Patty who are the ones protesting outside Southwest Key headquarters.
Antonia and I left Austin feeling like we didn't have all of the answers. The way he justifies his salary and the line of his work is by talking about the quality of the care that he offers migrant children. But since ORR denied access to Juan's shelters, it's hard for us to testify to the quality of the care that he does provide.
But we did get the opportunity to speak with someone who toured Casa Padre, the converted Walmart. Jennifer Podkol from the Kids in Need of Defense Fund, an advocacy group, told us about her main concern.
Putting children in institutional-like settings and in facilities where they're holding hundreds of children.
She toured the shelter before the zero-tolerance policy was enacted and was concerned even then. She specifically finds the size of Casa Padre to be problematic.
We were dismayed when they opened the facility because it was so large. It was able to house over 1,000 children. And so we were very concerned about that kind of institutional-like setting, particularly at a time when kids were spending so long in these facilities.
Jennifer says that since zero tolerance was announced last year, there's been a huge backup in the system, which has meant that kids are spending much more time in the shelters than they used to. Today, the average is around 60 days, when it used to be 40 last year. Jennifer points out that although protesters have focused a lot of attention on the shelters, it's really the government that's responsible for family separation.
I think the ire at some points during all of this was a bit misdirected. So if DOJ and DHS hadn't put in place those policies, these kids would have never ended up. Many of these children would have never had to go to these facilities.
But even if the policy didn't come from Southwest Key, Jennifer thinks there are better ways to house migrant youth than using these big shelters.
So over the years, what we have done to all the different kinds of facilities that the government has run is really encourage them to use less secure and less detention-like facilities and really try to utilize situations like group homes and short-term foster care that are much more appropriate for children.
The zero tolerance policy has led to a lot more scrutiny on the shelter system. And since we interviewed Juan in Austin, more questions about Southwest Key have come up. And a quick warning to our listeners. In this next part, we're going to be talking about cases of child sex abuse. Recently, ProPublica broke a story detailing multiple incidents of sexual abuse at Southwest Key facilities, including details of how a Southwest Key employee repeatedly touched a minor's genitals in 2015.
The minor reported what happened to him, and the Southwest Key employee was arrested and later convicted on account of molestation. He did not return to Southwest Key.
Given this report, we called Juan for a follow-up interview.
And when something like this happens, it's certainly very, very disturbing. I think that What I will say is that, you know, we adhere to very strict policies on abuse and neglect.
Juan told me that every staff member has to go through extensive fingerprinting and background checks. They undergo 80 hours of training, plus an additional 40 hours every year.
We educate every child from the very beginning when they come to our facility. And we inform them, and we educate them, and we train them regularly that they are to report anything that makes them uncomfortable in any way, shape, or form.
Since that last phone interview with Juan, another ProPublica article came out detailing more severe sexual abuse allegations than the previous article.
A youth care worker for Southwest Key was accused of molesting at least 8 boys and is charged with 11 sex offenses in one of the Arizona shelters between 2016 and 2017. The shelter in question was cited in 2017 for failing to complete background checks on employees to check for former sex offenses. Another man was arrested just this past July at another Arizona shelter on allegations that he sexually abused a 14-year-old girl by kissing her and rubbing her breast and crotch.
In a statement about the case of the 8 boys who were molested, Southwest Key said, quote, "Any employee accused of abuse is suspended and law enforcement called. This is what we did in this case." Southwest Key declined to comment, though, on the background check issue.
While alerting law enforcement after the abuse has occurred is clearly better than nothing, the fact is that abusers have been able to get jobs at Southwest Key under Juan's watch.
One thing that these cases call into question is the scale of the organization, which is a sprawling system of 27 shelters across 3 states, housing thousands of kids. So, how is it possible to assure a safe environment for minors when Southwest Key is overseeing such a high volume of children and workers? I asked Juan if there's a part of him that regrets building a space like Casa Padre, that converted Walmart that holds up to 1,500 kids.
Well, it's yes and no, Maria. I know that sounds odd, but no, in the sense that I think if we had to do it over, we might not have built anything that big, right? Because I didn't realize that it was going to be used as much as it has. On the other hand, it takes care of kids. And the more kids that we're able to serve and take care of, we think the better, right? Because ultimately, even though we get criticized for developing all these detention centers and mini prisons and all that, ultimately, what our goal is to reunify these children with their families. That's what we're about. That's what our mission is.
Because you're saying that other people who are holding or sheltering these kids, their goal or their mission is not to reunite them?
Well, I think...
Maybe hold on to them and make money off of them? I mean, I'm not quite sure.
No.
But Juan, you know, hold on a second. They're going to hear you saying, my goal is to reunite these kids. And they're going to say, pero Juan, actually, no, you are housing the kids. Like, what do you say to that critique where they're saying, no, Juan, you don't actually want to reunite them? Because if you did, you'd take all of your effort and put it into actually helping those reunifications happen by finding family members instead of sheltering these kids. Let somebody else do that.
Nah, I don't know that you understand what we do, Maria. As much time have we as
no,
we
no,
spent
I understand. I mean, I'm pushing back.
You know,
I'm pushing back.
Let me do. You got 50 to 100 kids coming in every day. What do you do with those kids? What would you do? 50 to 100 kids every day. What would you do with them? I'm asking you, since you're criticizing what we do, I'm asking
well,
you.
Well, I'm being
what
a journalist.
What would you do? You have 50 to 100 kids that show up every single evening. What do you do with them?
What if I'm not in the business of sheltering kids, period, at all?
It's very easy to criticize us. Very easy. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do. But you tell me a practical, doable solution of what you would do if you had these kids.
What if somebody said, well, why don't you put them all into foster care so those kids are actually in a family? They're not in a shelter. They're with a family. And that you, what you would do, your service would be to intake the kids, get them with foster families, and to provide the services that you do provide during the day, the schooling, the food, the no sé qué, pero que, that they sleep in a foster family because that's going to allow them to feel more family-like.
Well, a couple of things. One is the foster care system is not a great foster care system.
here in the state of Texas or Arizona or California. They are worse than even shelters are.
Okay.
And secondly, the federal government is not going to be funding this kind of work to be done at a foster care level. Now, there are some facilities, and we're looking at this ourselves, is the idea of developing foster care for some of these children that we cannot reunite with their families, have to stay longer, and those kids, to keep them in a foster care facility. But that is not an answer, Maria. You have 150 to 100 kids in. Where are you going to put them a day? Where are you going to put these kids? How are you going to find foster care parents?
Juan is right that states in which his shelters are have foster care systems that are known to be problematic. In 2016, a Texas federal judge declared the state foster care system, quote, unconstitutionally broken after he heard of the conditions former foster care children had to endure. There are other migrant shelters that have taken a foster care approach. Cayuga Centers in New York has the kids during the day for activities and instruction, and then they go to a foster home at night. But Cayuga has had its troubles, too. A New York State oversight agency recorded 54 substantiated claims of abuse and neglect just in these past 5 years. How to properly care for tens of thousands of minors who have come into this country alone is a very complex question. Juan believes it's something he's uniquely qualified to do.
We did it with Clinton, we did it with Bush, we did it with Obama, and we've done it with Trump. And the work of dealing and working with these children, of bringing them, addressing them, providing all the services we do, and then reunifying them with their families, that hasn't changed with any of these four administrations.
Juan is basically saying he's doing the work he's always done, no matter the political climate. But whether he sees it or not, the nature of his work is very different today than when he first started 20 years ago. For starters, he's making exponentially more money and housing way more kids in his shelters.
And the current administration he is working with has shown that it prioritizes immigration enforcement over the welfare of children and migrants, as we saw when they took away children from their parents at the border.
The zero tolerance policy might be over, but the people who created it are still in power, and Juan continues to work with them. In fact, he told us Southwest Key is in the process of renewing its contract with ORR.
The zero tolerance policy wasn't enough to make him break his relationship with the government. But the question is, given the way immigration policy's been going, when will Juan be faced with another moral dilemma? And if and when that happens, what will Juan do? Thank you, Antonia, for reporting this story with me. And since we last spoke with Juan Sanchez, there's been some news. Unidos U.S., formerly known as the National Council of La Raza, which is one of the largest advocacy organizations for Latinos in the United States, it's a membership organization, and Juan once served on the board. Unidos has officially announced that they have suspended their affiliation with Southwest Key programs. They say they've done this as a response to the sexual misconduct cases that have come to light. Today's episode was produced by Antonia Cerejido and edited by Marlon Bishop. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineers are Jeannie Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music that you heard on this episode, be sure to stop by LatinoUSA.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media, and I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And The Marguerite Casey Foundation. Change for families, by families.
The moral dilemma. The dilemma. Moral dilemma. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the story of a search for a long-lost family.
I guess it's been a long time. And then my first time when I saw that she could be this woman was that, wow, I thought, oh, look, she's been alive all this time and she didn't even bother to, like, look for me.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Newsy, the TV news channel with honest, in-depth context on the stories that matter. Newsy is for people who aren't satisfied with getting only the loudest part of the story. Newsy delivers more context, more solutions, and greater understanding of the people and events that shape our world. Learn more at newsy.com/watch.
At the start of your day, you need to know what's happening in the world, and that's why you turn to Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR, the news you need to take on the day in just 10 minutes. Hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.